So in the last number of weeks, we've been looking at some of the cultural elements of Israel and the Middle East. And what has come up several times is the customs of hospitality, whether it was about their tent and how they would have to host somebody in a certain part of the tent, or the foods, or the water, or just about everything we've looked at had some aspect to hospitality. And so I found an interesting thing on YouTube I wanted to share with you. This is a pastor at Abraham's Well in Beersheba, and he explains some of the importance of these things. He goes over some of what was taking place with Isaac and the military things that were going on. And then he brings it into more modern times as he talks about the David Accords when they were making peace between Israel and Egypt. And I just thought it was very interesting, ties a lot of what we were talking about together with an actual location. And so hopefully this will work.
Huge flocks of herds. He was possibly one of the wealthiest men in the world, or at least in this part of the world at that time. We know this because Abraham also had a private army. Some people could have even called Abraham, and I'm really reluctant to call him this, but like a warlord at one point, because he had over 400 mercenaries that he paid along with their families to travel with him. And Abimelech on the coast, remember the Philistines are seagoing people, now you have an inland people up in the mountains up here, and the Israelites are mountain dwellers, or Canaanites rather, mountain dwellers, and you have Hittites overlapping in this area. Remember Abraham got his tomb from a Hittite. So you have all kinds of different peoples. In here, but Abimelech needs his back covered. So Abraham has a private army, and it's mobile, and he's in this area. So Abimelech wants to make a treaty with Abraham. But the problem in this area, as Avi pointed out, is water, or the lack thereof. It's hard to come by around here. And so wells were dug. After Abraham died, Abimelech filled up a lot of these wells, because whoever owns the water owns the land, basically, and the people on it. They control things. But he needs Abraham. He needs Abraham to watch his back. And so they make a treaty with each other. And then some of Abraham's men get into a conflict with some of Abimelech's men over water and grazing rights and these sorts of things. And suddenly Abimelech wonders if he can really trust Abraham. Abraham then sends Abimelech 7 ewe lambs, representing 7 different wells, and an oath that I own this well, it's mine, but I will have your back and I will protect you. So this area here and this place here became known as Beer, I can't pronounce it quite properly, but Beersheba, which the 7 wells, 7 ewe lambs representing the wells, but also Beersheba, which is the other form of Beersheba, which means the well of the oath. And it makes a whole lot of sense when you hear it with that connotation. The well of the oath. Sure, it was the land of the 7 wells and the city of the 7 wells. In fact, this area was also the land where Hagar was sent out, off in that direction, but it was in the region of Beersheba where she was actually sent out, and she found a spring that God gave for her. So anyway, this is the well of the oath. And here, again, Abraham may have, probably did, dig this well. We're talking going way, way back. You're sitting in a place that's, right now, we're talking about an era of 3,800 years ago. But Beersheba goes back about 6,000 years. This place is incredibly old. So with all that in mind, the well of the oath between two people, here we go. Abraham, who is called by God, and he's going to be he's the exalted father, Abram, and then father of many, Abraham, and he's here. God made an oath with him that he's going to be the father of this great nation, the Jewish people, the Hebrews. And over here, you have these idol-worshipping pagans on the coast. And he makes a deal with them right here. I'll protect you. I've got your back. Now, there had been a long-standing feud, war, conflict, put the word to it that you want, between Egypt and Israel. In fact, it goes back thousands of years, the conflict between Egypt and this land, the people of Israel. Well, it kind of broke out in its worst way, as you know, in the more recent wars with Israel, as Egypt being part of the 1973, where the Yom Kippur War, as you know. And the conflict after the 73 war left Egypt in a very precarious position. Of course, the Israeli forces got within just a few miles of Cairo when they were called back, because World War III might have just broken out. It didn't, but it was about to. And Egypt was now in a position where it had to rebuild, it had to negotiate peace with Israel, and they didn't want to do it. National pride is on the line. Honor, which, remember, the people that live in this part of the world, they deal with honor and shame. This is how the life works here. You shame me, I get you back. And Egypt was in a bad spot at that point, because Israel had come back from almost annihilation and won this amazing war. God did it. So, of all the interesting things that could have happened in the late 70s, Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, through an American newscaster, Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America, suddenly announces on the air during a live interview, I'm going to Israel and I want to meet with Begin. And this shakes the world. It was a mundane interview until then, and suddenly he announces this, and everybody says, what did he just say? And Walter Cronkite, of all people, begins making phone calls and helps set this up. There were a lot of people involved, but it's interesting that he was. And in the process, finally, Sadat goes to Israel, and Begin, Menachem Begin, the prime minister, is his host. And it's quite an occasion. As a matter of fact, it's unprecedented. It's really the first time in history that an Egyptian leader has moved into the land of Israel and actually seen Jerusalem in peace. Not as a conqueror, but as a visitor. It was quite amazing. Well, shortly thereafter, Begin is invited to go to Egypt, but it's 6 months later, and it's in the Sinai, and they don't even, it's not even in an honored position. It's almost an insult is what happens, without going into excessive detail here. And it seems like the process is beginning to just deteriorate overnight. President Jimmy Carter, who was not America's greatest president by any stretch, but did the greatest thing of his presidential career, he got on the phone to Sadat and Begin and said, come to Washington. Let's work this out. We have an opportunity. Let's not let it slip through our fingers. They fly to Washington. They go to Camp David, Maryland, where during the process of negotiation, it got so bad that Sadat and his group packed their bags. They were ready to walk out, and there was a breakthrough. And suddenly, they could agree on something. And they came up with a document that many of you know, because you were alive at the time to see it, as was I, something known as the Camp David Accord. 6 months later, the men come back, and they have a great table set up in front of the White House, Sadat on one side, Begin on the other, Carter in the middle, and they sign this document in triplicate. And the world rejoices. Absolutely goes nuts. They're nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. People are shouting, Peace Prize, Peace Prize. And then they stand up from the table. They gather together, all three of them, And if you've seen the pictures that were taken, they all but hugged each other, which would have been rather undignified for these important world leaders. But they shook hands and each grabbed each other's arm and they pulled themselves in and they're smiling ear to ear. These mortal enemies with this American president there who had helped orchestrate this whole arrangement. And the world is saying, peace, peace between Egypt and Israel, an impossible thing. Who would have imagined in any lifetime that this could possibly happen? A few weeks later, something else happened. And it was, as far as I know, never reported in the West. I had to come here to learn about it. And it is on the internet. You can read about it. Avi looked it up. You see, in this spot, at this well, Sadat and Begin met again. Back in 1979, back in May. May 29th, I believe it was. Is that correct? And they met here. And part of what they did was they, of course, you sign a paper. You're signing a document. You're making an oath. A covenant with another person in modern terms. But in this part of the world, a signature on paper with many of the peoples here mean very little. It's a sign, it's a signature, it's the way we do things now. But the old way of doing things is something we even talked about at the Garden Tomb, something we talked about in the upper room when we were there. That when you break bread with somebody, you tear off the bread, and you don't have two pieces of bread, you still have one piece of bread. Remember, it's like dropping a coffee mug on the floor. How many coffee mugs are on the floor when it shatters? Just one, just in a lot of pieces. But when you break bread with somebody, it's not only hospitality, it's peacemaking by the ancient mindset. Jesus, the bread of life, made us not only at peace with God, but made us relatives with God, his kin, his children, bread of life. Take the bread of life from heaven, we belong to God. But you do it with one another, and it's reconciliation. And kings in ancient times would reconcile by eating with each other. They would sit down, they would break bread. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You see. So here, these two men went here. And in front of the well of their common ancestor, they're the same blood. They diverged a long time ago, but they're the same blood because of that one man, Abraham. And this was his well, and well is life. That they took a piece of bread, one of them, who knows who brought it out, I don't know, I still don't know. And they broke it, and they both ate. And even though they're both dead, Sadat by an assassin's bullet, Begin from a broken heart after the passing of his wife. The peace still exists between Egypt and Israel, and it's tense, but strong. Not because two men put a signature to paper and then almost hugged each other out in front of the White House, but because two very brave men had the guts to stand here and break a piece of bread and eat it and declare to the world, we're brothers. We're related. We're brothers under the skin now. Bread that went into you went into me. The bread that went into me went into you. What do you do with that? We have now ratified our oath with each other. And that happened right here. That's an amazing thing. But it shows you how people reconcile. From kings all the way down to peasants. From God through Jesus to the entire world, whoever takes the bread of life. That is an amazing thing. Well, another thing about this place, and I'm going to be much briefer now, is that you were all the way up in the north visiting a very, very well-watered place called Tel Dan. Well, you have now gone from Dan to Beersheba. That's in the Bible. The extent of historic Israel actually went much further at times, but basically, it was from Dan to Beersheba. Those were where the tribal allotments are, and when you hear that mentioned in the Bible, they're talking about the full extent of the nation. Now you're in Beersheba here. And there's one last thing I wanted to mention. You know, if you look down this wadi here, this ravine, you'll see a Bedouin camp down there. And as you look in the Bedouin camp, down in the, towards the Bedouin camp to the right of it, you'll see some animals out there grazing away. And right out in the middle of some of those animals, you'll see a person walking. Maybe two or three. My eyes aren't quite that good anymore, but can you see the people down there by the animals? Let me ask you a question. Who are they? What do they do? The answer is, well, I assume that they're herdsmen, shepherds, whatever they might be. They're Bedouins. But do you know them? Do you know their names? I don't. I don't know who they are. They're just little specks on the horizon. The most colossal figure in human history, I'm not talking about God's history, I'm talking about human history, is actually not Jesus. He's the most important person that ever entered this world, for sure, with no close second. But the most important historical person in the world to date is Abraham, because more people in this world know of him than anybody else who has ever lived in history. He had that great of effect on people. He is the father of the Jews. He is the father of the Christians. He is the father of the Muslims. All of this combined, they all recognize him somehow as the origin. Everybody knows him. That one man was no bigger than one of those people. Might have been wealthier, might have been more renowned because he had the wealth, he had the army, he had the influence. But he was no bigger than one of those people. And at a distance, you wouldn't know him from anybody else. You wouldn't recognize him from anyone else. What can God do through one normal human being? Especially a guy like him who tended to mess things up like everybody else. He did a lot of things that were kind of, well, man, he shouldn't have done that, Abraham. He did it anyway. Like us. Well, we've done so many goofy things, wrong things, my past, my home, whatever it might be. What can God do with one person? When we started this tour, we talked about why the Holy Land was called the Holy Land, and it's not because the land is holy, even though it does belong to God. There's no question about that. He made the covenant. This is his land. But this land is soaked in blood up to your neck. It's holy because of the people who were here, because Jesus was here, because Abraham was here. Now, Jesus was perfect, but everybody else, they weren't. But they were still saints, remember? Holy ones, God's holy ones. And right where we started, I'll say it again. Only God can say, if you're not the next Apostle Paul, or Mother Teresa, or Joanna, or Mary Magdalene, or Peter, or Stephen, or anybody else. And we're still talking about them, and we still know their names, though we wouldn't know their faces any more than looking out there at a distance. One little tiny speck on the horizon, what effect could they possibly have on the world? What effect could you possibly have on the world? That's Abraham out there, and you're sitting right here. What's he going to do with you? I just wanted you to know these things. This is a great spot to talk about just that.
He probably said some things that I would have phrased differently, but I thought overall that was very well presented. I thought it was interesting and just kind of ties together a lot of the elements that we've been talking about in a very practical way. So this evening, study to show yourself approved. Education. As we look at all of the cultural elements, we can't miss education. Now, no kid likes education, right? We don't like going to school. We don't like being taught things. Why is that? For one, it shows us we don't know as much as we think we do. We can't do things perfectly. That's frustrating. And to realize that it has been a significant element of culture all the way back. This is not the evolutionary mindset. Evolutionists have a very low view of human intelligence in terms of ancient history. But that's also not the evidence that we see coming out of the ground as archaeologists are going and digging up these sites. And so as you think about it, and we see biblically, of course, God created Adam, and Adam shows great intelligence from the very beginning. He gets his first biology lesson from God. He sends him out here, and he brings every animal by him so that he can name them. That takes a tremendous intelligence. Could you name the animals if you had nothing to go by? I mean, we have so much technology, we have so much education, we have so much experience. These things have already been done for us. He did it from nothing. I mean, it was a brand new experience. What do you call this animal? Well, I'm going to call it a dog. What do you call this animal? Well, that doesn't look like a dog. That looks more like a cat. You know, and he names all of them. So man, from the creation perspective, was created intelligent. And we see that going forward as you look in Genesis, that it wasn't very many generations, and you begin to see specialization. Now, of course, a lot of early history, man was just trying to stay alive. He would do the things which would give him shelter and food and comforts. And then as those things were established, they began to specialize. And when you specialize, what happens very quickly, you become commercial. Okay? So if I'm spending my time making a musical instrument, I'm not spending my time planting a field, making the tools that I need to tend my garden. I'm not doing a lot of the things that would be necessary to maintain my life. I'm making a musical instrument. So now there's got to be a trade. I've got to trade my musical instrument to you for something that I need, food and shelter to stay alive. And so once you start specializing, you begin trade. And when you begin trade, you also begin record keeping. Because my instrument takes me half a year to make, it's worth half a year's food. And so now how are we going to keep track of this? I'm going to give this to you now. I need the food when it comes. Or I need the food now and I'll give you the instrument later. And so we have to keep a record of these things. And then the further those trades take place, you know, you're going to satisfy your family's need for a musical instrument fairly quickly. But now we got to take our musical instrument to the next community. And so all of this becomes complicated, and it requires record keeping. It requires map making. It requires any number of things. And so very quickly, with intelligent beings, they're going to develop systems. And as they develop systems, we call it technologies, and those technologies are then taught to the next generation, so they're not starting fresh every generation. So education then is not just what I've learned on my own experience from God's gifting of me, as we see some of those things seem to be gifts of God to those individuals, but now I'm passing on my knowledge to the next generation, and that requires education. And so education is very important, and it's very evident going clear back into history. Nothing proves better the intellectual and business ability of early man than his business records. That's from the book Tells, Tombs, and Treasures. Archaeology has unearthed not a pattern of slow caveman development, where we move from really crude things slowly over long periods of time to complex things. But what they're unearthing as you go back into history are well-established technologies, well-established sciences, reading, writing, arithmetic, literature, map making, all kinds of things is already developed. Now, they didn't necessarily have all of the knowledge that we have, but it wasn't rudimentary. And so we see this as we see the things that are being dug up. Libraries, dictionaries, archives of kings, histories, lexicons, encyclopedias, grammars, commentaries, works on religion, laws, sciences, medicines, bank drafts, deeds, sales records, mortgages, bankruptcy proceedings, purchase agreements, ship registries, discharge papers, stamps, which proved that they had a postal system, maps, records of trade routes, school training tablets, high math, multiplication tables, where they went not just 1 to 10, they went all the way to 50. They were teaching their children. They were able to divide the circle into 360 degrees, the day into hours of 60 minutes and minutes into 60 seconds. They had formulas to figure the volume of a cylinder. I took geometry. I still don't know what the formula for the volume of a cylinder is. Something to do with pi, and it's complicated, right? This is not rudimentary stuff. And yet, these archaeological digs take us back within a few hundred years of the flood. So what's that tell us? Very likely, Noah comes through the flood with an education, and that he's taken that education and he's given it to his children and his grandchildren, and they've developed it further. But, you know, you don't just develop these things overnight. It's something that had been developed over time. One record tells of a man who buried writings before the flood and dug them up after. Now, I'm not putting that in there to say that it happened. Okay, it's a story. But what it's pointing to is there's an ancient story, number one, about a worldwide flood, but that there was writing that was taking place before the flood that would have been buried and dug up again. It was something in those generations following the flood that they had a concept that that could have been possible or even probable. One Mesopotamian king loved to read accounts of the time before the great flood. I don't know if those were genuine accounts, documents from before. Was it stories made up? I don't know. But again, we're talking about an expectation of that generation that those before the flood had a capacity to write and to put that in a form that was able to survive into the future. Post-flood records found in Ur showed children were taught reading, writing, arithmetic, geography, botany, and drawing. Why do we choose Ur? Abraham. That's where Abraham came from. There's a possibility that Abraham went to school. We don't have any proof of that, but it would have been a possibility. They had well-developed schools in Ur at the time of Abraham. They used tablets to do their homework on, not electronic tablets. It's kind of interesting as I studied this today. I'm thinking, you know, how far we've come is not necessarily great. They had tablets. They wrote on soft clay with a stick, and it gets laid out, neglected, buried, and 3,000 years later, we dig it up and we can still read it. What happens when you take your tablet and bury it in the yard. 3,000 years from now, nobody's even going to know what it is, let alone be able to make it to work. We go from writing on something that can last to writing in ways that don't last to writing in ways that just numbers and ones and zeros with electricity, and it's not going to endure. Now, who's really the smartest ones? Those that were able to write something that generations later can be found and studied? I don't know. We think ourselves so smart. Students had tablets with corrections found from the city of Mari. The school at the time was called Tablet Houses because they used tablets to do their lessons on. The schools had a school father who ran the school. He had an assistant who prepared the lessons. And one of the tablets read, "I read my tablet, ate my lunch, prepared my tablet, wrote it, finished it." It kind of gives us a picture of the school day for a boy back in Abraham's time. And that's endured to this day. Where'd the first printing press come? We think of it in a much more modern terminology, but what really happened, they took clay and made cylinders, and they carved their document on the cylinder, and then they took another clay tablet. Of course, this one gets baked in the sun or whatever, makes it hard, and then they take it and they roll it on the soft clay tablet, and it puts the printing on the new tablet. So they were able to mass produce things, important documents or images or lessons or whatever. So, you know, we thought we were real smart when we invented the printing press. No, nothing new under the sun. In Egypt, some of the temples acted as education centers. Let's look at Acts chapter 7 and verse 22. Moses was instructed, he went to school, and was instructed in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians. There are indications in the things that Moses wrote that he not only knew how to read and write, but he also had competency in the decimal scale notation, geometry and trigonometry, and astronomy. And the Egyptian schooling, especially at that level of the royal family, would have included much more than that. It would have included concepts of metallurgy, anatomy, chemistry, and music. And we know some of those things just from the aspect of the mummies, that they knew how to take the body and remove the moisture, remove the organs, to put the chemicals in it to sustain it and to preserve it. And so a lot of that is very evident. Homeschooling, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 through 9. Codified in the Jewish law was the responsibility of educating your children in the things of God. And the ways that they did that oftentimes involved symbols and question and answer sessions. And as that worked out, of course, poor people wouldn't have the ability to send their kids off to school. They would have needed them to accomplish the mundane keeping alive activities. And yet, God says, you can't let their education be neglected. You teach them as you sit down. You teach them as you rise up. As you take the events of your day, as an opportunity to teach your children about the Lord. And the responsibility of education mainly fell upon the mother from the early age. And then as the child got old enough to work alongside of his father, the father took over the son's education. The daughters would remain under the education of their mothers, which is very important because that next generation was going to be taught by that daughter. And so, you know, there's a lot of accusations against the Bible against women. You know, it's very man-centered. But it does not demean women. They had a very important role, and it's a God-given role. It's a great responsibility. There was specialization in education. We see in 1 Samuel 19, 18 through 21. Okay, so what is Rhema? What's taking place there? Samuel had started a school of the prophets, and we see that on through the kings as we studied, and we see Elijah and Elisha involved with the school of the prophets, and they had them in different places. But Samuel seems to be the one that would have started that. There was a recognition that they needed an education in the things of the Lord to have it written and preserved and to be able to teach it to the people. And so whether you think of this as a seminary or it probably had some very practical things like how do you read and write? Those are some basic things that you need in order to further the work of the Lord. And so there was an emphasis in Scripture of teaching the Word of God, teaching the things of God to the next generation. But it's not at the expense of further education, because you see, God chose to use very educated men, not just the educated in the seminary, but people like Moses, who had been educated in all of the wisdom of Egypt, and you have Paul and others that had great educations, like Daniel. And so it is the Christian perspective to emphasize the importance of education. There was royal education. We could see that in 1 Chronicles 27, 32 through 33. Okay, so you have a highly educated man attending to the king's sons. You see it again, 2 Kings 10, verses 1 through 5, where Ahab had his children had tutors, or those that were over them. Daniel, in Daniel chapter 1, the whole aspect of the Babylonian king taking these prime young men out of Israel who were very intelligent and teachable and teaching them the language, teaching them the culture, teaching them the wisdom of the Babylonians so that they would then be able to function as governors. And so there you see a period of training as well as a period of testing. So education came with lessons as well as tests to make sure that you learned the lessons. The Jewish school was called the House of the Book, and Jewish children were sent to the synagogue at age 5 or 6. So that's kind of comparable to where we send our kids to school. I turn this thing off. The students would either stand around their teacher or sit in a circle on the floor. The Bible was the only textbook until they were 10 years old. And from 10 to 15, they then taught them the traditional law. And then they had a couple of different schools. Schools of thought, doctrine, classes, so to think, you know. And they would train up those kids according to that school of thought. And we see that in Acts chapter 22 and verse 3 that Paul was involved in that. Acts 22, 3. Okay, so that's the kind of education that Paul was brought up under. During that period of time, Paul's lifetime, archaeology has demonstrated that Rome had over 20 grammar schools, and that those schools were attended by both boys and girls, but mostly by boys. School started before dawn. Now, this is the Jewish school. The school started before dawn, and they listened to the teacher tell them about how Moses received the law. And then there was breakfast at the teacher's house where they would eat cakes that had letters of the law on them. They'd go back to school and they'd receive a slate with their lesson written on it. And the slate was smeared with honey. And the student would trace the letters with his pen. And as he traced the letters, the honey would get on the pen, and he would put the pen in his mouth, or the stylus, it wasn't an ink pen, but he'd put that in his mouth and get the sweetness. And so it was a motivation to learn. Copy your lesson, get a sweet treat. All right? But it came from the idea of Psalm 119:10, where the word of God is sweeter than honey. And so they're teaching them how to read and write right out of the scriptures. And that's a process that continued in modern education up to the founding time of our country. They would use the Word of God and even start right in Genesis chapter 1 to teach them how to read and how to write. Acts 19:9, Paul taught in a school at Ephesus, and this is possibly a school facility that wasn't being used, or the hours that it wasn't being used, he turned it into a school of his own. Schools were also called gymnasiums, where they would study literature, philosophy, and politics. The Areopagus was a school in Athens where there was prominent teachers that taught under the general supervision of a committee. So we have our first school board. Galatians 3:24, the schoolmaster was a family slave that escorted the student to and from school. For years, they thought schoolmaster was the teacher, but in some archaeological findings, the schoolmaster was the slave that had the responsibility to take the child from home to the schoolhouse so that he didn't get himself in trouble along the way and make sure he got to school. And that is how he was using that in that text, that the law was the schoolmaster that brought people to Jesus Christ, who was the teacher. So I thought some of that was kind of interesting. But what we see is education is important. It's been important all through history. We need to educate our kids. Kids need to embrace education. We see that education and religion were tied together. They were educated at temples. They were educated for the Jews in their synagogues. It isn't until modern time that we've tried to separate that concept of religion and education. And it's when we see Christian schools and things, they're kind of, you know, not the mainline way of educating kids. But really, they're just kind of getting back to the old pattern of things. And the primary thing that we must educate our kids so that they can know the Word of God, so they can read it and communicate it, so they can know the Lord, know his salvation and know about their Savior. And that's why Christianity has been a driver of education down through the years. So that's education.